Hi, this is Shai.
Get up, rise up, wake up, do everything. Like, what is Kumo?
Kumo is a social movement. And Kumo statement is that our generation need to take charge on how Israel is going to build herself in the next few decades. It's very ambitious.
So here I am with Yonatan Shimriz, founder of Kumo, a nonprofit organization that focuses on creating new leadership in Israel. Before we start, can you explain where are we right now?
We're in the offices of Kumo.
So we're going to get to Kumo and everything that around that, but before that, you have a super important story, I think. If you and I would have met on October 6th, where were you? Who were you? What kind of person?
I think I can say that I was an happy person.
A happy person? Happy.
I lived in Kfar Aza. I built a new house in Kfar Aza. I saw my future in Kfar Aza. I married. My daughter was born. I built a factory with my two brothers in this region. And I saw a future in the Western Negev because it's a beautiful place, beautiful area. Sometimes there are wars and missiles and alarms, but overall, I think it's paradise. It was paradise.
It was paradise.
Yeah.
What happened? Take me back to October 7, 6:29 in the morning.
So my wife wakes me up. She really need to she shook me really hard because I never get up from alarms and anything. After 20 years, you don't get any excited.
After 20 years of
alarms
of alarms of sirens of missiles.
So she's from northern Tel Aviv. So she's immediately woke up. At that time, she was a pregnancy at risk, 26 weeks pregnant. She just got released from the hospital a week before. And I was really afraid that she's going to get into labor. So I had to keep the environment as calm as I can.
So you went into the Mamad?
The Mamad really took her hand with my three-year-old daughter, Yali, and with my two dogs. Went to the safe room, to the Mamad, and as soon as I closed the Mamad, I told Natalie, listen, this is very unusual. I think this is, there is kidnap right on the border. As far as I understand, there are probably crew, Israeli tank crew that doing his way into Hamas tunnels. I've been in every war. In the past 20 years in this region, and it was very unusual. After 5 minutes, Ido, my brother, sent me a message that he will serve in the security team of the kibbutz, a civilian security team. It's called the Kitat Konenut. It's a first response unit that assembled only civilians from the kibbutz. And he told me, listen, Yonatan, there is terrorists inside the kibbutz. The commander called us to take the gun from the armory. I have to go. Lock your door. Now, I forgot to say that I'm the eldest among my brothers and sisters. I have two brothers and one sister. So there is Ido, Alon, and Ronnie. And Ido served in the first response unit. And as soon as he go to the armory, I get video in a different WhatsApp group that don't really relate to the kibbutz, and you can see white Toyota trucks with big guns behind them, like go one after the other in the back gate of kibbutz. Immediately I zoomed in and I understand this is kibbutz Kfar Aza, it's my kibbutz. And when you watch the video, you can't really grasp what you see. It's like so hard to you don't believe, you don't, like, you don't understand where you're at. And I understand that I need to check if, like, this is like real thing. And I opened a news app, Israeli news app, and I saw the same truck with the same gun in the middle of the road, which is the biggest city in American terms. It's very small one. It's like a village, yeah. But in Israel, it's like
it's the biggest city in the area.
In the Western Negev. And I saw the same truck with the same gun in the middle of the road. I understand immediately that we are in a different world right now. Immediately, I went from the shelter, from the mamad, from the safe room to the kitchen. I grabbed some kitchen knives because I understand that we are going to encounter terrorists.
What was going through your mind when you're grabbing a kitchen knife?
I was very logically, very structured minded. I tried to understand how long we're going to be in the safe room. And I assume that we're going to stay for an hour until the army will come and fight the terrorists and, you know, the air force and everything. So I grab some kitchen knives, a bottle of water, and the birthday cake of Yali, my daughter. She was born on the 7th of October, 2021.
So that was her birthday?
Yeah, we're supposed to celebrate birthday in my house. I was decorate the house just night before with balloons and everything. And all the family was supposed to come.
What an image, like, just to think of it, you're going to the kitchen to grab, like, a knife to protect your family and a birthday cake to give your daughter a birthday she deserves.
Yeah, now I look at the birthday cake and I told myself it served two purposes. Like, first, it's food, it's resource, and second, it's like will make the environment inside the safe room a calmer, maybe, you know, because it's a birthday, it's happy. And as soon as I went back with the birthday cake and the knives, I get another message from Ido. And now it's a totally different message, totally different vibe. He told me, listen, Jonathan, I've been in contact with 50 or 60 terrorists. They are wearing IDF uniforms. They're talking fluent Hebrew. They came here to work. Like, and they are fully equipped. I managed to kill some, but there were too many, and I had to back up. Yeah. And he told me that half of the security team got hit very badly, which I immediately understand that they are dead. Yeah. And the security team of Kibbutz Kfar Aza, they were like 14. All of them good friends. Some of them are my best friends.
My understanding is that Hamas terrorists, they had a map of the kibbutz and they went immediately to the armory because they knew the security team will go there to get the weapons.
Yeah.
And they basically ambushed them there.
They ambushed the security team and they knew phone numbers of people that had the you know, high-ranked job in the kibbutz, like the management of the kibbutz. They had their phone, their addresses inside the kibbutz. They didn't only ambush the armory. They knew where is someone from the kibbutz that is a soldier or a policeman or even nurses. And they went them parallel. So every nurse in the kibbutz was killed right away.
Wow.
So they don't really get to help people that wounded or something. Yeah. So they really conquered the kibbutz very, very early. That now, you know, in 7:30 in the morning, when you have your pregnant wife and your daughter in your safe room, I understand that my best friends are dead and there is no any armed force that now encounter terrorists. So it's now it's like Russian roulette. Like you wait to do that, to die, basically. And I told myself, listen, Jonathan, in order to, you know, to be able to, you know, go through this day and to survive, I need to keep the environment inside the safe room as calm as I can. If my two-year-old daughter will get mentally scratched for the rest of her life, It's like something I can't bear. And if my wife will get into labor inside the safe room, I'm done. So I need to keep the environment inside the safe room as calm as I can. So nothing will go through this door. Everything that happens inside this cell phone is between me and the cell phones.
So while you're getting updates, of course your daughter is only two, but you're keeping this from your wife as well.
Yeah.
Wow.
You know, I told myself, this is the happiest day of my life. We're going to celebrate birthday. It's like, you don't cry, you don't yell, you don't talk too loud. Everything is to make your daughter better inside the safe room as long as it takes. I don't care. But in this safe room, it's festival mood. Like, we are happy. No matter what happens here, it's between me and the phone.
Was it difficult to create those two worlds at the same time?
It was almost impossible. I think this is the thing that will haunt me, I think mentally, to the rest of my life. Because as soon as I close this amazing deal inside my head, we start to get messages from all around the kibbutz in the WhatsApp groups of the kibbutz, which in the kibbutz is a very close community. You know everyone by name. You immediately understand that the kibbutz was basically conquered. And 7:30 in the morning, and my friends that spread in the kibbutz, the different regions and neighborhoods, getting murdered in their own beds. So you start getting messages, they're here, they're trying to break my safe room, they shot me, they hit me, where is my kids, where is my parents, they're burying my house, it's cold, it's hot, they're throwing a grenade at me, I don't feel my leg, don't feel my arm, like, very hard. And the 10 in the morning alone send me a message.
Alone is your younger brother.
Yeah. Send me, he used to live in, it's in Hebrew it's called the Dor Tzair neighborhood, which is a young generation neighborhood. It's like, it was lived there. It's all the age group between 21 to 32, like 30, something like this. And it's like the happiest neighborhood in the world, I think, pre.
So basically, young, single men and women, no children, and, all know each other.
And he sent a message that terrorists go inside his house. And I understand that this is going to be the last time I'm going to speak with my brother. Like, in the past 3 hours, I understand that the people that send those kinds of messages after 5 minutes, don't write anything. So it's like one-way ticket, I assume. And I wrote him back that I love him and he's strong. And he sent me a heart emoji, and this was the last time I spoke with my brother. And it was the hardest test to keep the promises that I, told myself, and not like try to go out and save him, or like try start crying or something like this. Like, I was like, and I didn't told anyone from my family about this message. I thought back then that there is no like added value to telling them that there is something like this happening
you
right
were,
now.
It sounds like you had a mission to survive, to keep everyone calm, to make sure no one's traumatized.
Yeah.
It sounds like the right decision at the moment.
You don't know what is the right decision, but you like, yes, I think that back then, your mind is like so in a survival mode. You don't have any need, you don't hungry, you don't thirsty, you don't need to do anything. You're focused on the best way to survive, and the best day to survive is to keep the environment calm inside the safe room because I have family. And
so what happened to Alon?
Alon was, I thought he was killed. But later on, after like 10 days, the IDF told us that he was kidnapped. We were like 22 hours inside the safe room until the IDF saved us. Most of the time I had to play a game with my daughter in order for her not to like sing songs too loud because there are terrorists outside. So we play, instead of telling her, Yali, shut up, there are terrorists outside, I told her, Yali, we're going to play a game, a whisper game. If we whisper, we'll get the balloon when we get out. So every time she tried to like sing a song, like rightfully, she had to restore a chocolate cake, a birthday cake, and you know, and she saw YouTube for 3 hours. It's like all the all her dreams come true when she was two. And this in this way, I managed to keep the environment as calm, and for her, it's like a game now. We need to whisper. And after 22 hours, we got saved. My brother Ido was in his safe room for 30 hours, and we arrived to Shfaim. This is where we at, Kibbutz Shfaim, and we were sure that Alon was dead, and the IDF just needed to identify his body, and that's it. But the IDF told us that there are so many bodies. It was chaotic, the you know, the situation in Israel, and it told us to wait. And we waited for like a week.
Do you remember what that wait is like, or was it?
No, just waiting for like the let us know that it was like you identify his body. It's like you have no hopes. It's you have no hopes, and you are like you don't really. You are not able to talk. You are crying the whole time. You are crying the whole time. The first few days in Kibbutz Shfaim, a few weeks, it was like, you know, the imagine yourself seeing someone, your friend, that you thought it was dead, walk in here, and you're like seeing him after 3 days that you were sure that he was murdered, and he was, you know, lost his contact because his phone is like burned or something, and he ran, you hiding for 2 days in you don't know where, and you see each other, and he was sure that you are dead, and you were sure that he was dead, and this encounter is like something that you can't explain in words. You're like, we hug each other. And for half an hour, you don't talk, you just cry. And you understand that this is now a new world. Like, you don't forget everything. And after 1 week, the IDF told us that he managed to identify all Kibbutz Kfar Aza bodies. 62 bodies.
How many people were in the kibbutz in total?
I think like 800 in total.
So almost 10%.
Yeah, 62 people have murdered in the 7th of October, and 19 were kidnapped. So yeah, 10% of the kibbutz population is...
What did you feel when they told you the good news is Alon is alive, the bad news is he was kidnapped? How do you...
I saw it only as good news. There was no bad news. And so basically, every news that he was alive, I didn't care where, it was like, it was the happiest day of my life. Okay, I immediately understand that Alon is very, very sharp mind. Is like, you know how to adapt, how to, very strong physically and mentally. And I was sure that if he's in Hamas tunnels and he's alive, he's going to stay, he's going to walk out alive. I thought it's going to take a year to really stay Alon. Because if they, you know, if we start to do deals like in parts, like partial, yeah. So he's the in the end of the line. But I knew that he was going to be okay. I was sure. And I thought to myself, okay, you're going to do 300% inside, I'm going to do 300% outside, but I'm going to make it happen. He's going to walk out. And I tried to understand what is the best way to bring to a hostage deal. And I tried to map you know, all the players, all the international environment, what is the who need to be pressed in order for to lead to the hostage deal.
This was October 2023.
Yeah, it was like right after they let us know that he was kidnapped. And after 1 week, I understand that the only way to bring to a full hostage deal and right away, it's to put Qatar in the terror list, in the world terror list. Because Qatar plays a key role in this conflict. From one hand, she's, you know, sends billions of dollars to colleges, universities in Europe and US. She's buying football teams, airlines, everything, properties all around the world. She's see themselves as like a very modernate country, the democrat, the only democrat in the Middle East, you know. And from the other side, she's playing key role in the, I said, they really insert in the radical Islam indoctrination to those places. She hosts all the Hamas leaders in Doha. She pay a lot of money to Hamas.
Yeah.
So, and if we want to really make an impact, we need to make some of the world leaders say that they intend to put Qatar in the terror list. And the mashmawiyot, the consequences of that they're going to take all Hamas properties and bank accounts and everything worldwide, which Qatar will not agree to. And
so that was your thinking when you're looking at, which by the way I have to say is very logical thinking when your brother is in Hamas captivity and you're thinking, okay, so what's the maximum pressure I can put on the most key players to make it, to get to a deal.
And this is what we've done. So in the beginning of November 2023, I've been in the capital already. I spoke with senators, congressmen, I spoke with the ambassador of Qatar in DC. I've been hosted in the Speaker of the House conference, which I spoke live in CNN and Fox. And we spoke mainly on Qatar. I spoke with Senator Stefanik, which handled the hearings of all the president of the Ivy League universities about the influences of Qatar inside those universities. And 1 month after, we've been in the European Parliament, in Strasbourg and Brussels and Paris, spoke with the president of the EU Parliament, spoke with the prime minister of the EU Parliament, with, you know, with many EU Parliament members, parties over there, you know, foreign media, the president of the Red Cross, everything, every person that can do something in order to understand that Qatar, she is the main problem. Like,
what did people tell you when you were having these conversations with really important world leaders?
I think that you spoke with so many politicians, and it's really hard to understand what will motivate them to really do something. Sometimes you can speak with someone and the only thing that is like want is like to hear your story because of he's very curious. Because Israel, you know, I met with some world leaders that was the first time that they met someone that was on the 7th of October. Israel didn't do a very good job in terms of hasbara,
like showcasing to the world what happened.
And I understand that immediately after the 7th, like in the 8th of October, there were already pro-Palestine protests all around the world. You feel that you are like advocating for the state of Israel, but you only care for your brother. And you don't care how tough and how hard the schedule and how tight is the schedule, and you know, you're just running and try to do whatever it takes, and you don't know who you're going to touch that will do something.
How did you feel in the first, the very first ceasefire and hostage deal in November 2023 when the children, the babies came home, the older people came home?
So from
did you hope? Did it frustrate you?
It was like it's complex. It was very complex for me because I was afraid that we're going to go into partial deals, and I was afraid of that because the position of my brother, he was a young Israel man. Of course, I was happy because I have friends that came back in this deal, in the deal in November. I was the neighbor of the Goldstein Alamog family, which the mother with two sons and one daughter kidnapped to Gaza, and on the way Hamas killed their husband and their eldest daughter, and we were neighbor for like 6 months in this hotel. So of course you are so happy that they are here, but you understand that there is good probability that you'll see your brothers in a few years.
And what happened on December 2023?
So on the 15th of December, the IDF came to my family and sat us down and told us that unfortunately Alon was killed during the IDF operation. It was just only 2 days after we went back from the European Parliament. So we still was so like... and then I really felt the air leaving my body. Like, you really feel the... And I saw a black screen. And you know, it's like it was so abruptly, so like out of the blue. And I didn't really imagine any script, any scenario that Alon will not make it. And I thought to myself that I pray for like. I really wish to die when they let us know. And I didn't saw any light. It was very deep. You know, in my mind that there is no way out.
What did the IDF tell you of the circumstances of Alon's death?
So only after really, as days goes by, you understand that what happens to Alon is like something else, and you understand that the IDF called us after 10 days and told us that they managed to do a tahkir,
like an examination.
Yeah, examination of the. And they told us that Alon, Yotam, and Samer on the 10th of December went from the tunnels with their captives and go inside Hamas member house, like, and they were there, and Golani crew, like after like few hours, went to the same house without them knowing that there is somebody inside this house, and in order for the IDF to go inside a high-profile house that probably has something in, and they send like a robot or like a camera just to look inside, maybe with a dog, to see if there is somebody in, if there is explosive over there, before they're entered. And in this case, they put GoPro on dog, and then you can see a movie like that. And then you can see the dog go, like, enter two rooms and then go in a staircase. And then all you can see is, like, dust and fur. Like, the terrorist wait on the staircase, and the top of the staircase. And they shot the dog and threw a grenade at the dog. And then it's all you can see, but you can hear. And then you can hear some Arabic. Gunshot, and then you can hear Alon in your tongue screaming for help. You can really hear him.
In Hebrew.
In Hebrew, yeah. Alon, Yotam, we're here. We're chatufim, we're kidnapped, yeah, we're here. And then you can hear gunshot again. And this leg was the fight between the IDF and the terrorists. The terrorists tried to flee. The IDF managed to kill them. And some of the IDF soldiers heard the screams, but they thought it's maybe Hamas trying to manipulate them to go inside this house and trap them.
Right, which there were cases where Hamas
Many
were recording
cases, yeah.
and then playing Hebrew screams of help so that soldiers would come
Many
closer.
Cases of Hamas with dolls, with speakers, and then just keep going. And Alon Yotam and Samer stay still for like a few hours, and then they went on the 11th of December and start walking in Sajaya, which is a neighborhood in Gaza. And they walk like 4 days. And they walk like 2 kilometers. They move from house to house. During that time, they was like writing signs for the IDF. Let them know there is like hostages inside this area. And they wrote with spices on table maps and put them in the outer walls of buildings, and also just, you know, 3 hostages, help, SOS, everything. But the IDF didn't really understand that this is like a real case. They thought that Hamas trying to lure them. On the 15th of December, they reached to their final destination, I guess. And they were, I guess they heard Hebrew, so they understand that they're going to meet Israeli forces. And they asked themselves what is the best way to really encounter Israeli forces. So they told themselves that they need to strip off their clothes and make a white flag. And that's what they did. And they walked to an open yard without knowing where, like, the Israeli forces are. And they reached like 30 meters from the IDF force. They mistakenly identified them as terrorists and shot and killed them on the spot.
Your brother sounds like a really strong,
yeah.
incredible man.
Yeah, very smart, very talented.
How old was he?
27. So.
Yeah. Many people, when they would get really such devastating news, like I can't understand how you keep going, would just stop. And yet, less than 2 months after that, I think it was on social media, you posted a picture of you incorporated a new NGO in Alon's name. Tell me about those 2 months. What happened?
So 3 weeks after my brother was killed, my son was born. His name is Lavi. Now he's a very big guy. And it was very tough for me, you know, just trying to imagine yourself go to the hospital to, you know, to hug your newborn, and you don't really happy. You are so numb. But when Lavi was born, I would look at Lavi, and I thought to myself that I need to do a soul searching. What I did wrong, what I need to do in order for Lavi and Yali to grow in Israel, in better Israel, that they will not need to suffer even 1% from what I've been suffering in my life, and what is my role in the correction of Israel, in the building for a new Israel, better Israel. And for 1 month, I had a lot of soul searching and asked myself so so many questions. And as you said, after like 2 months, I founded an NGO that's called, her name is Alone Building an Exemplary State. And the target of this NGO is to commemorate Alone through the changing of the Israeli diaspora and building a new leadership bottom up in the municipal area and in the politics, like in regional and national leadership. Because I understand that for so long in Israel, and you can say that worldwide, for many years, they build, I say they, it's like the leadership everywhere, building walls between civilians, between society. And they give you a name, they give you the you know, the messages, and they give you everything, and they say, okay, you need to be in one of those
different tribes.
Yeah.
You got the Haredi, you got the religious, you got the
Ashkenazi,
secular.
Ashkenazi, the Smolani, the Yemani, the everything. The Ironi, Kibbutzniki, everything. Like you have, and they can keep inventing things. Like it's not, it's never ending.
It's divide and conquer.
Yeah. And and they told you, listen, life is binary. It's one or zero. If you are there, you're not there. If you're in this tribe, you're not in this tribe. But if you're in this tribe, everybody around you is your enemies. And this, I think, it's the worst thing that happens to Israel ever. And I think we are the, I think the biggest threat of Israeli existence is the you know, the society that is so divided between themselves.
Right. The tribalism and the polarization are basically threatening to kill Israel from inside.
From the inside. I think that we can build anything, and we can't win, you know, outer enemies out there if you don't really fix the basic things in the Israeli society.
So what would you say are the basic things that need to be, that you're working to fix?
First of all, the changing of the language, like not, you know, the way we speak has a huge influence on, you know, even physical things inside our minds. It's really dictate the way we behave and the way we think.
And so the way we speak about other people or?
Any, you know, in any way, in any aspect, all right? Even the words that they build, the tribes, are words that was, back then it was, you know, they had like an ideological background, they had values, they had like, and now it's like, it's a dust.
Right, so like when, so the American version is when you meet someone and you immediately label them as a Republican or a Democrat. In Israel, it's Smolani or Yemeni.
Yeah.
The moment you do that, you've created in your mind a division, and they're either your side or the enemy's side.
Yeah.
And you're fighting to change that.
And I think you can see it in all the world. This is really something that need to be, this is an issue that need to be addressed. All right? Life is not binary. It's not. You have like 95% gray area, which is complex area with so many dilemmas, so many, you know, choices that are like complex things. You can be that and you can be that. And all those things can live inside your mind. But the social media has make us so extremes because you can see only, you know, one thing, and the algorithm is so like always bring you the flickering thing and the one that shout the most and say the most like horrific things, because it's make the most engagement. And now you're involved, like emotionally involved in your tribe, that you're, you know, sink inside of this, and you're like really force yourself. And every time that someone tried to attack your tribe, you're going with your spears and everything to the comment section and trying to like for 2 hours you know, making, you know, discussion with someone, and it may be a bot that, you know, and you think it's going to, like, if you win this argument, you're going to open news everywhere, and you're going to save the world, and you're so involved, you're so invested, emotionally invested in your tribe, that now to try to lift your head, and it's like, it's you're already inside, you're invested, and it's so hard to, like, say, okay, maybe it's the wrong way. Maybe there is something, okay? I believe in some values in this tribe. But what is there is this tribe? And why we are in tribes? Is it my grandfather came from Argentina. He built a kibbutz in southern of Israel called Mishmar HaNegev. My mother born in the kibbutz. My father was born in Iran. In place, magical place called Abadan. Okay, he came with his family to Ashkelon, to one of the worst neighborhood in Israel, I think, when he was 6. My grandparents from his side didn't know Hebrew. They spoke Iranian, Persian for like the rest of their lives. He came from religious environment, from different environment, like from kibbutz. In Israel, you have so many people from so many places. The Israeli society is like amazing mosaic of people and cultures and narratives and ideas. And for so long, they highlighted, I said they, it's the leadership, through the media and everything, highlighted how different we are from each other, and how we can build nothing together. We don't have common ground. Instead of taking all this amazing, you know, narrative and ideas and, you know, everything, and build something that is so strong and it's so good, this is what they did. And I think that if we understand that the first thing need to be changed is the way that we speak with each other. Because I can argue with you on like 1,000 things. Yeah. And it's okay that we will not agree on everything. And in the past year, I've been in every place in Israel, all right, trying to implement what I'm standing for. And I've been in Haredim places, in yeshivot, in the settlements, in places that are like in Tel Aviv, in schools, universities, colleges, everywhere. And when you meet with person without any, like, without the phone, like in person, you understand that many of the things that you thought, or they thought, it was like real walls, real tribes and everything, it's like, it's not really hold something behind it.
I met 2 days ago a woman who only knows me from social media, and we talked for about 45 minutes. We started the conversation and ended the conversation by her telling me that I'm an enemy of the state, because I interviewed Ohad Ben-Ami, who came back from 491 days in Hamas captivity. And I was calling for another hostage deal, to save the Jewish lives. And, you know, we had a good conversation. I didn't change her mind. She didn't change my mind. But in the end, I hugged her. And I told her, next time you think, you see something I say and you think he's the enemy, just remember this hug. Like, you don't have to agree with me. You can also be angry at me, but don't hate.
I think this is the basic thing that we need to understand. Of course, you have like the extremists from each side, like 5%, that they are like, okay. But I think most of the people, I think in across the world, in all the world, want to live their life peacefully, all right? And they don't want to every time get so mad at what. I think they maybe got addicted to social media, that they see those messages as extreme messages, and they like, we need to like
turn down the heat and turn up the leadership.
Exactly.
So changing leadership. Tell me about Kumu, which translates to get up
or
wake up.
Rise Up, everything.
Oh, Rise Up.
Yeah.
It's your version of like anti-woke. Instead of woke, get up, rise up, wake up, do everything. What is Kumu?
Kumu is a social movement, like from the safe room, you know, people from the safe room, the people that got hurt the most, understand that they need to take the lead. They need to build something different because we are suffered the most. The people that were in the safe room, the miluimnikim, the reserves, the one that got evacuated from his house. I still live almost 2 years in caravan. And I'm a refugee in my own country. And Kumu statement is that our generation need to take charge on how Israel is going to build herself in the next few decades. It's very ambitious, but we need to understand that Israel today is not, say, in a good shape, it's like to say the least, but it suffered from a vacuum, leadership vacuum, ideological vacuum, and we need to build new leadership. So Kumu as a leadership program that aims to take regional leaders and build them like everything that they need in order to become national leaders and to create network of leaders that will go inside politics, inside municipal councils and change Israel immediately. And in Kumu we already have some good projects that we are doing in the past and we're doing right now. I think the first phase of this leadership program will initiate in the end of October.
And October 2025.
Yeah. And hopefully in 2026, we will be able to make more than 100 leaders that go inside the public service in Israel in any level. And those leaders will carry the message that we need to talk different and we need to build Israel different. Because when Israel built in 48, you ever planted a tree in your garden?
Yeah.
All right. So, you know, when you plant a tree, yeah, maybe I told you about this. No?
Yeah.
All right. When you plant a tree, I was working the gardening in the kibbutz. There was like for 2 days. You plant a grow tree, like not this tree, like, you know, some. You need to plant the tree and then you put like four sticks, you tie the four sticks to the tree and then you pour some water and you go like this. You go straight, no matter what. After 6 months, you can untie those knots and then you grow by yourself. In 48, Ben Gurion put the tree and he didn't have time to put the sticks. He said, okay, there is a war. You know, people from Auschwitz just arrived in the ships and then put him Uzi or something and told them, let's go to the front, that there is war. We don't have time to put the sticks. And as in my experience, in the Noi, in 2 days experience, if you don't put the sticks, the tree is going to start, you say, leaning
to one side or the other, then it will fall.
Yeah, so it started to lean year after year after year. And from this amazing tree, there is branches that all of them from the same tree. Like this is the tree that all of those branches just evolving from. And when the tree reached to this level of leaniness, I think it can harm.
Oh.
And Kumu mission is to take this. This is the only solution that I know in my experience. Say, okay, thank you. And to plant new tree. Mm-hmm. And then put the sticks. And then tie the knot.
So start from the beginning.
And there is no other way. There are many cosmetic solutions that will probably bring you the most from media attention to votes if you're going to be a politician. But they're not going to fix Israel. They are like very nice messages, media messages, but they are not.
So if someone said, Yonatan, I love what you're doing, I love the ideas, take the keys to the country. Like, tell me what are the first three or four things that you think we need to do?
Okay, so in my perspective, the first thing that needs to be done in Israel is constitutional reform. In Israel, because of Ben Gurion didn't put the sticks, there are so many legals, loopholes.
Loopholes, yeah.
And we are discovered that if we have 61 Knesset members, we can do whatever we want in Israel. And I think we need to...
Which is true both for the left and the right.
Yeah, yeah.
Right,
yeah. And it's this is not how it's supposed to work. Like, everyone that arrived to serve the public need to serve all the public, no matter which party you are. And it's very dangerous because today you are here in the 61, but tomorrow you are not going to be. So it's like... And if I take Israel like in a basketball game, when you have like very rules and laws that are very firmly, and you know everybody knows basketball, that there are like the outer lines and the baskets and the four quarters and 12 minutes a quarter in the NBA. Here in Israel it's 10. We are lazier. And what is foul, what is traveling, and everything. And here in Israel, in this government, I don't think it's happened, never happened in other government in the past, that they're starting to erase the outer lines of the field, and now you can argue where the ball is crossing the line or not. And Israel needs to have a constitution. And of course, it's like if you ask me if it's like doable, and then I don't think it's doable. We need to break down the constitution and to put laws that will, be the new constitution, but partial.
You know, someone who's listening would say, oh, you know, I really love Yonatan. I love his ideas, new leadership. We need all of this. But it sounds like he's just like anti this government. It's just like, again, talking about no tribes, but going into like left versus right again. What do you say to someone like that?
That I don't really care. And like, personally, I don't care who is in the government. And now in Kumu, and in my perspective, I'm looking on the future. I think all Knesset members are irrelevant for the correction of Israel.
All 120.
They are, in my perspective, they, when you want to build a new, to speak a new language or the new mindset, so left and right, small and mean, it's like in the past. It's like, it's not like. I started to use the word old world and new world. Mm. All right? Because it's so obvious for me what is my old world. Like after... You know, pre-7th of October, everything over there you need to erase from your memory. Like, it's not, this is not your life. It was like something else from different Gilgul. It's not related to you. Now you're in a, you're not in a comfort zone. You're building something new. All the people that were connected to the old world, they are not, they're irrelevant to the building of New Israel, in my perspective. I mean, there are some many good people in the old world, many of them, but they are all branches from this tree. Mm-hmm. All right? And they can whisper in your ear and they can like give you something from their experience, but the new world people need to build the new Israel.
So in this new world, new Israel, I'm gonna ask you like a list of different identities. Like, tell me, do they have a place in Kumu? So obviously you and I, you know, we come from different places, different backgrounds, but yeah. People would look at us, we'd say, okay, like the secular, like of course you're half Iranian, but like the secular Ashkenazi Jew. Okay. What about a religious Jew?
I think everyone has a place in Israel, in the new Israel. as long as they believe that Israel should be and stay a democracy, this is a Jewish country, all right? We don't have any place else. And Israel needs to be safe. So as long as you understand that Israel is democratic, Jewish, and safe country, and you believe in those values, those, like, poles, everyone can enter. Even if you're going to say Arabs.
Yeah. There's no reason for them to not want it to be democratic and safe. And with the Jewish, it's an understanding that that's the majority.
Yeah, I mean, there are many, many countries where Arabs are minority, where it's a Christian country. It's stated it's a Christian country. And Arabs are 20% from Israeli population.
What about Haredim, or ultra-Orthodox Jews?
So Haredim, also, they have place as long as they believe that Israel is democratic and they need to contribute from, you know... I mean, if you look about the draft, you know, the law of, to recruit Haredim, if you take those values and you understand that in order for Israel to be safer, we need more men and women to come to the army and help. So you understand this is a critical need for Israel. If you understand that Israel is Jewish, so you need to encourage Judaism, right? So in my perspective, I don't care, and I want, okay, that there will be a small minority of, like, the elite of the academic Jewish Haredim that study Torah and Talmud and everything, and they're going to enrich all the Jewish people all around the world, and they could not serve like Israelis have Israelis, like, how do you say, Excel sportsmen.
Yeah.
When you're very good at something and you're like, you have like a bright future in front of you, and no matter what, in Israel, they give you like, you don't need to go to
the army. Like Danny Ovdia.
Yeah. And okay, so you have like 500 people each year that are so good at what they're doing, that okay, we don't want you to give up your future. The opposite, we want you to represent us in the world, and to, you know, to build a very strong sportsman, you know. Same in the Haredim. I want to build a very educated shikhva,
like a special unit of Torah studies.
Yeah.
And but everyone else would join the
everyone else Golani.
Okay. What is the role of Jews in the diaspora outside of Israel in Kumu? How can they help? How can they support this new Israel?
So there are few ways to do it. First of all, even if it's like technical, if you can like follow Kumu, if you like share contact of Kumu around
what's
the world.
What's the, so we know?
Kumuil.coil. Okay. And you can just register in our website, and then you can get newsletter. You can go into WhatsApp groups and, you know, be more active. We always seeking for resources in terms of money and contact in order to reach more audience, bigger audience. I've been in the US in a really short tour of like 2 weeks, and I met many Jewish communities in Boston, Washington, Philly, New York. I spoke with them about the role of the Jewish diaspora, mainly in America, and how they are like, what they can do in order to help us, not only Kumu, like the Jewish community around the world. And I think that we need to strengthen the knots, the ties between Jews around the world.
They are part of this new Israel, even if they don't live here.
Sure.
They are 100% part of this.
I think that the, if you will build a new Israel, good Israel, strong Israel, it will reflect any Jew in the world, even if they don't live in Israel, don't want to live in Israel. Because now I think Jews all around the world encounter things that we've been encountering only on 1930s, 1940s. And it's something that, you know, make you do two things if you're a Jew. Or you're like, grasp the Judaism very tight and say, this is me, you know, fighting on my Judaism and my personality, and I, you know, this is me. And the other side is like, fuck it.
Running away. Yeah.
Like, I don't have the tools now. I have a family. I'm like two generations abroad. I just want my sons and daughters go to school, to university, and I don't care. And this is something that we need to deal with.
If Alon walked in the door right now and he saw everything you're doing with Kumu, we didn't talk about the memorial service that you run for October 7.
Yeah.
What do you think he would tell you?
That you want to join. To join and lead. First of all, I want to say, we'll enter the room and said, let's grab a beer.
So you started, when I asked you if I met you on October 6th, what kind of person were you? You said happy. We're now at the end of August 2025. I'm not going to ask you if you're happy or not. But I do think that you at least either have or fake having a lot of hope.
Well, it's totally different, two different things.
So what gives you hope?
The Israeli people, because I met a lot of them in the past year. Tens of thousands, like so many from all of Israel. And I know that the majority of Israel, of Israelis, want to build something new. And they feel that the people in the Knesset are not representing them. Most of the Israeli population don't feel represented in the Knesset. There is a huge disconnection between the leadership and the people. And I believe that when there will be election and everything, so many good people from the civil movements all around Israel will step up and start to change the things that works inside the Israeli politics.
Well, I'm on your side. I hope you're right. I hope you're right. Todah Rabah, thank you for taking the time to tell us about Alon and about Kumu. And I can only wish you good luck. What can I tell you? Batzlacha.
Batzlacha lanu.
Todah.